Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Happy Saturday! This is the time of year when the North Pole is on a lot of folks' minds. And to be very clear, this Saturday Classic is not a Christmas episode at all, but it is about an attempt to get to the North Pole.
It is, in fact, the Polar Expedition of S.A. Andre, which was made by balloon in 1879. And this episode came out on April 15, 2015.
So enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And many of the history makers of the world were people who were considered a little bit mad by their contemporaries. You know, it's usually the people with great bravado that do something a little bit crazy and end up kind of changing the world or making some amazing discovery. Today's topic, which features a man and his expedition, it definitely falls into that category. But the unmet goal of the plan has left a lot of room for debate about how he's defined and how this mission is defined. This is going to feature some high adventure, some really wild courageousness, and just positivity in the face of what I think would break most people. So we're actually just going to jump right in and not really set it up a whole lot. And we're actually going to start sort of at the end of the story.
So that end where we're starting is a discovery. White Island, which is known as Kvitteo in Norwegian, is an island in the Svalbard archipelago. And Svalbard means cold coast, which makes sense because all these islands sit in the Arctic Ocean. White Island is normally completely covered by ice, except for two little points of rock. But in 1930, there was a really warm spring and summer, and more of the island than normal was exposed.
And because so much of the ice on White Island had melted, a Norwegian sloop called the Bratvag, which was on a combination scientific/sealing mission, was actually able to stop at White Island. And during the sloop's time there, a geologist named Dr. Gunnar Horn and his team followed these walruses that they had spotted on the island. But while they were following these walruses, they found, much to their surprise, something that they had absolutely not been looking for, which was a diary.
The book was pretty wet. It had been sitting under the ice as the ice melted, and parts of it were stuck together. On the opening page were the words, "The Sledge Journey, 1897.
And so when the geologist, Horn, took this book back to Peter Eliasson, who was the captain of the Bratvåg, he discovered that two of the sealers that had been traveling with them had also made a discovery. While they were exploring White Island, they first found a metal lid, like to a, what had possibly been to a tin of food, and that kind of gave them pause. And then, not far from there, they found a canvas boat. And this boat had a hook, and the hook was stamped Andre's Polar Expedition, it's actually P-O-L period, E-X-P period, 1896.
They explored the area a little more and quickly found a lot more stuff, including a headless body, which was reduced to little more than a skeleton. Its clothing was monogrammed with the letter A. And then they all kind of put the pieces together. While the men aboard the Bratvåg had landed in White Island to study science and hunt seals, what they had actually found was the remains of a long-lost ballooning expedition, which had tried to make its way to the North Pole 30 years before.
And so that man that they found others as well, but his name was Solomon August André. And he was born in Gränna, Sweden in 1854. Just for very brief on him as a young man, when he was only 16, his father died. He became very, very attached to his mother. They were already close, but that deepened when his dad passed away. And he attended Stockholm's Royal Institute of Technology and studied engineering.
In 1876, then 22-year-old André traveled by steamer to the Centennial International Exhibition in Philadelphia. This is a journey that would turn out to be really momentous for André because while he was reading about winds during this journey to the Atlantic, he was inspired to think about balloon travel.
And when he reached Philadelphia, he actually got a job at the Swedish Pavilion at the expo as a janitor. And he took advantage of his location while he was there by visiting a Philadelphia resident by the name of John Wise. And Wise was really famous for his work in ballooning. And because Wise had flown in all manner of weather conditions, and he had walked away from virtually every possible type of crash that a balloon could have, André felt like this man kind of served as proof that ballooning was a perfectly safe mode of travel.
The two became friendly, and André requested the chance to accompany Wise in his balloon, which the experienced balloonist agreed to do. But the planned day for their trip, which was a 4th of July celebration, wound up having really high winds. The balloon collapsed before the trip could even start. And before they could reschedule their outing, André got sick and decided to go back to Sweden.
And once he got home, he was still obsessed with this balloon idea. So he decided that he needed to raise funds to purchase his own balloon. And he did this by setting up a machine shop, but that, unfortunately, was not really a great money-making plan. He ended up in a great deal of debt, and he really found the whole idea of running a retail business really unpleasant to him. He didn't like marketing. He didn't like the mode of marketing that was popular at the time, which was talking trash about competitors. He found the whole thing distasteful. It just wasn't a good fit for him. So he closed up his shop, and he still had never had a balloon ride.
When he was 28, André participated in the first International Polar Year as part of the Swedish delegation. Austrian explorer Karl Weyprecht had inspired the International Polar Year, being certain that there were meteorological and geophysical problems that could only be solved by a cooperative effort that was aimed at gathering and studying information from the Earth's poles.
So this was actually a huge event. 11 different countries sent delegations to work on these coordinated expeditions that were part of this first International Polar Year. And André's group went to the Svalbard island of Spitsbergen. And one of the experiments that was conducted there actually involved André being confined indoors for an entire month to see if his skin color would change. And it did. It took on this yellowish hue that had been seen in other people after they had been through an Arctic winter. Prior to that, they weren't sure if that was something going on with their vision having been altered and people just looked that way, or if there was actually something happening in the skin that changed its hue. And then due in large part to André's work in aeroelectricity, the Swedish delegation was really recognized for the impressive results of their work as part of this bigger cooperative effort. And after this expedition was over, though, André went to a fairly mundane job working for the Swedish Patent Office.
He did, however, finally get to take a balloon ride, and that's what we will talk about after a brief word from a sponsor.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
So, despite the fact that Andre had been fascinated with balloons since he was only 22, he had not actually gotten to ride in one, and that didn't even happen until he was 38. So for 16 years, he had kind of been pining for this experience. And his eventual escort in this was the man who's called Norway's first balloon skipper. And his name was Captain Francesco Chetti, which I know is an Italian name. He was of Italian family, but he was Norwegian. I'm not sure how the Norwegian language shift would have changed the pronunciation of his name, so we're going with the Italian version. Chetti was an interesting figure in his own right. He was also a mind reader and a starvation artist, where he would go without food for long times as these big sort of public stunts.
Chetti was kind of annoyed by Andre's behavior during this first outing. He called it, quote, disagreeably calm. According to Andre's own account, he was trying to be completely aware of his mental and physiological responses to the situation, noting that while he didn't consciously feel any fear, his body acted in ways that suggested he did unconsciously feel some fear going on. He found himself, for example, tightly gripping the ropes on the balloon. He took only one more flight with Chetti before deciding that he ought to get a balloon for himself.
And he was actually able to finance the purchase through a Swedish science fund. This was basically a fund set up for people to use money if they were going to work on science projects or things that would better the Swedish people as a whole. And so once he had his balloon, he took 9 solo trips in it. And each time he was really scientific about carefully detailing his observations. Remember, his education was engineering, so he was a really excellent note taker. And on one trip, he actually ascended to 14,250 feet. That's 4,343 meters. So for context, cabin pressure in modern airplanes is set to correspond to what humans would experience up to 7,000 feet or 2,100 meters, a little over that. So he was basically flying in this balloon without protection at twice the altitude that safety regulations say we should aim for in terms of keeping people comfortable and safe. And he described this during this journey, a lightheadedness and a terrible headache and a faint singing noise on the left side of my skull. So for another comparison to a previous episode, we've talked about Mount Everest, which is 29,000 feet. However, most people that summit Everest are using oxygen tanks to help them along. This is a case where there was none such.
They're also acclimating on the way up. They're not just ascending in a balloon all that way. I'm surprised they didn't get the bends.
Yeah, he was a resilient dude.
So maybe he did. We just don't know. So anyway, on another of his trips on his balloon, which he named the Svea, he tested out the use of drag ropes and a sail to try to steer the vessel. And these would eventually become important as part of his eventual plan to explore the Arctic.
And after his 9th trip, he sold his balloon to a museum. It was an outdoor museum where they would have space to put it. And his engineering background and his wind study and his experiences in ballooning had basically given him a really big idea.
At this point, a lot of explorers were totally focused on the North Pole. Numerous countries had launched missions to go north, and of the 1,000 men who had tried to get to the pole, 751 had died. So most of them. It was really serious business, and being the first to get to the North Pole was going to be a significant point of pride for whatever country could claim it.
And so on February 13th of 1895, when he was 40 years old, so this is only 2 years into his ballooning experience, André addressed the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. And during that speech, he outlined his very ambitious plan to travel to the North Pole via balloon. And a few months after his talk at the Royal Swedish Academy, André gave basically the same talk to the 6th International Geographical Congress in London in the hopes of getting funding in the form of a little less than $40,000 worth of money. I think I've seen it listed as around $38,000.
Traveling by balloon and leaving from Danes Island in the Svalbard archipelago, he expected to go north for about 43 hours to reach the pole. The balloon that he traveled in would be outfitted with the drag ropes and sail that we talked about before to try to enable steering and control of the balloon.
The next part of his plan involved crossing over the pole and then continuing over that point to travel for several additional days. And his intention was that he would eventually land in Asia or perhaps Alaska, depending on how the wind moved him. And once he landed, he planned to travel over land on foot until he found civilization so he could arrange for travel back to Sweden.
It may surprise you to learn that André's outlook, as he described this whole plan, was positive and enthusiastic, even when talking about the possible obstacles he might encounter once he got the balloon on the ground and tried to find his way home. He could use waterways to travel, he said, and he seemed really confident that even if he landed in a desert, he would surely find vegetation and shelter, and surely any people he would encounter would give him directions or help him back to civilization.
He really was a positive thinker. I gotta give him props. He felt like this plan to reach the pole was going to succeed where others failed. And that was because he was going to circumvent all of those perils of traveling by sled or on foot by taking to the air.
What may have really been the moment where André won over the crowd was actually something of a jab that he made at one of the men who tried to contest this plan. American General Adolphus Greely made his opinion known that he thought this plan was foolish and had not been thought out.
And Greely, you may recognize that name, had been the commanding officer of an expedition to the Arctic Circle in 1881. That was the Lady Franklin Bay Expedition, and it was intended to gather scientific information about the Arctic and to set a new record for the farthest point north that had been reached by explorers. And this expedition met with great tragedy. The crew ended up stranding in the Arctic for years, and all but Greely and five other men died, so the majority of his crew did not survive that.
In response to Greely's objections to this three-man balloon plan, Andre said, "I risk three lives in what you call a foolhardy attempt, and you risked how many? A shipload." So, as Andre left the stage, the entire hall cheered him.
And in the end, most of the money that he needed for his polar balloon came from none other than Alfred Nobel and Sweden's King Oscar II.
Before we get to the exciting adventure of the expedition itself, let's have one more brief sponsor break.
Yeah, the breaks are a little close together, but that's because I want to keep the whole expedition all in one piece. So we'll have a quick break and then we'll come right back to it.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
So once he had his funding secured, Andre commissioned a Parisian-built balloon, which was made from layers and layers of varnished silk. And this balloon was named the Eagle. The hydrogen balloon was 100 feet, 30 meters tall. And to protect this impressive inflatable as it was readied for flight, as they filled it with air and got everything ready, he also had a house built for it on Danes Island, which I believe was five stories tall. And this custom house actually had a felt-lined interior so that anything the balloon touched would not damage it. And one entire side of the house could be quickly removed when the balloon was ready to go. And the windows were made of gelatin. Like, it was basically everything soft that won't hurt this balloon.
Andre chose two other men to complete his crew for this ambitious plan. These were Niels Strindberg and Niels Ekholm. Strindberg, who was 23, taught physics as an assistant professor, and he was also the cousin of the famed playwright August Strindberg. Ekholm was the oldest of the team at age 47. He had led the Spitsbergen expedition that Andre had participated in, and he was an experienced meteorologist.
And so for several weeks in 1896, the eager Andre and his companions attempted to begin their journey, but they were just constantly thwarted in their efforts by unfavorable conditions. And to make matters worse, as winter set on, Ekholm left the team. He didn't think this was such a good idea after all, and he bowed out.
Fortunately, Andre already had an alternate at the ready. That was Knut Frankel. He was an athletic civil engineer and was 27 years old. But his troubles were not over. Andre's mother died suddenly as they were preparing to set off in 1897. While Andre seemed kind of placid to those around him, he was really deeply melancholy at the loss of his mother. He wrote in his journal, quote, "The only thread which bound me to the wish to live is cut off."
Yeah, she was really his only, like, close relationship. He mentioned at one point when he was younger that he really just decided he was never going to have romantic interests because he knew he wanted to become, you know, an explorer and do great things once he had married this idea of ballooning. And he didn't ever want a woman to make the tearful, you know, request to him to please don't go and do this thing, and him having to say, no, I'm doing it. So his mother was really, it really was his one tether. And so without that, he was sort of starting off with a bit of heartbreak. And finally, after they had waited for the perfect conditions and the winter had passed, the team was finally able to leave Danes Island on July 11th of 1897. And I sort of love this. But the last words that Andre was heard to utter by the onlookers were, "What's that?" as the balloon had struck something as it headed out on its expedition.
Maybe unsurprisingly, given the inauspiciousness of those words, almost immediately there were problems. The drag ropes were pulling the basket down into the water and they had to be cut. The three men aboard also quickly dumped about 450 pounds or 204 kilograms of sandbag ballast to try to lift their transport out of the icy ocean. As the vessel and its team, who were still struggling with these problems, vanished out of the sight of the onlookers, they were traveling north at about 20 miles an hour, which is about 32 kilometers an hour, and the ropes that were designed to help them steer were now gone.
Yeah, so they were drag ropes. Not a great idea. You don't often see a balloon tootling around with a rope dragging from it to the ground, and there are reasons for that. So what happened to the team next was actually put together from the journals which were found in 1930. And while all of the men wrote records of this whole wacky adventure, Andre, not surprisingly, was the most prolific writer of the group.
The first night of their journey seemed to be really incredibly joyous. Andre marveled at seeing the vast expanses of ice, which were dotted by polar bears. In the morning after the first night, the team had breakfast and coffee, and they traveled through some hazy conditions that were just above freezing.
And as the day stretched into the afternoon and that misty weather continued, the basket dropped and it bounced repeatedly on the ice, as often as 8 times in 30 minutes, according to their records. They had lost enough hydrogen that they could not stay aloft, but despite this bumpy going, the team all stayed really upbeat.
While taking a watch as his comrades rested, Andre wrote, "It is not a little strange to be floating here above the polar sea, to be the first that have floated here in a balloon. How soon, I wonder, shall we have successors? We think we can well face death having done what we have done. Isn't it all perhaps the expression of an extremely strong sense of individuality, which cannot bear the thought of living and dying like a man in the ranks, forgotten by coming generations? Is this ambition?"
And as that bumpy ride continued, seasickness kind of hit Strindberg. That he was really getting quite ill. So they dumped a great many of their sandbags so that they could get enough lift that they would stop thumping on the ice. But as the third morning of their trip came on, the basket once again dropped as the conditions turned even foggier. And then it suddenly rose high in the air as it warmed up a little bit. And the team released some gas so that they would drop down a little bit again. But they were just having trouble regulating their place in the air. And after fighting with the situation for a while and
Growing a little more frustrated, they finally decided to land on the ice, and they did so at around 8 a.m., and at this point, they had been traveling for 65 hours, and they were more than 500 miles, or about 800 kilometers, into their ride.
For the next week, the three men plotted what their next move should be. They had, as part of their preparation, made plans for various possible events, and this included packing sledges, or very heavy sleds, for each of the men to pull. So the trio spent their planning time carefully selecting what they would load onto these sleds, which they pulled using ropes that were wrapped around their shoulders like harnesses. These sledges weighed hundreds of pounds, so this was really no small task, and sometimes the men would all three pull one sled and then go back and do the same with the next one and then bring up the third.
And they had also arranged to have depots set up in two places in the events that they needed them. The first was on Franz Josef Land, which was part of a Russian archipelago. And the second, smaller depot that they had arranged was on the Seven Islands, and that's back part of the Svalbard archipelago.
After they had packed their sleds, the first men set out towards the Russian depot. The men managed to shoot several polar bears along the way and prep them to use as food. Picking their way through the ice floes was really treacherous and exhausting, but the men all seemed to bolster one another. They did fall into the water from time to time, though, and the average temperature stayed around 32 degrees Fahrenheit, or 0 Celsius, although it did drop from time to time. So I would imagine being in wet clothes, I wouldn't even imagine, I would know for certain, being in wet clothes in those conditions would be very treacherous.
It would, and miserable, but really all their diaries are so sort of like positive. It's almost freaky.
I wonder
we'll
if
get
it's,
to one reason.
I wonder if it's because hypothermia was affecting their attitudes.
Maybe. We'll get to one reason why they might have been happy despite their seemingly miserable circumstances. So several days into their trek towards Franz Josef Land, there were two major setbacks. First, Frankel started to experience snow blindness. So this is known clinically as photokeratitis, and snow blindness basically occurs when the cornea of the eye becomes burned by ultraviolet B rays. This happens a lot in cold areas with lots of ice and snow because it reflects off the snow up into your eyes even when your head is down. Second, they became aware that they had been walking east on the ice, but that same ice was actually drifting west at a much faster pace than they were making. So they had been struggling all that time with the sledges and working out all the pushing and pulling, and they really had made no headway whatsoever. So by August 4th, they abandoned this plan to travel east to the Russian archipelago, and instead they decided they would switch directions and head to the Seven Islands depot.
To make matters worse, the temperature started to drop by several degrees, and fortunately, they did have food supplies, including butter, bread, and biscuits, as well as water. They supplemented this with polar bear meat when they could, and they even tried eating the bear meat raw, as well as making blood pancakes out of bear's blood mixed with oatmeal and fried. They also made algae soup, which does not sound nearly as disgusting as the bear blood pancakes to me.
I was talking with friends about this last night while I was working on it, and I was describing blood pancakes to one of my friends who is also a big foodie, and he goes, "That sounds kind of French. I'd try it." And it does. Then when I thought about some of the things my grandmother cooked, it does sound pretty French. So despite their exhaustion and this totally desperate situation, the tone of Andre's journal entry still is almost oddly positive. And this could have been because in addition to their food rations, they had also brought quite a bit of opium with them. They used it as a pain reliever and also to treat diarrhea. And they also had morphine. And in some cases, they were double dosing with the opium and the morphine. Frankel, in particular, seemed really plagued by problems. He twisted his knees. He had digestive distress. This is actually kind of ironic because Frankel, one of the reasons he was chosen was because he was very athletic and they kind of envisioned him being like the strong pack mule of the group. But he seemed to struggle the most with all of this travel. So according to Andre's notebooks, he was the one that they were kind of constantly having to figure out when he needed opium dosages.
In the first days of September, the crew managed to travel by boat, which, while grueling in its own right, was a really welcome change from pulling these heavy sledges. To celebrate Strindberg's birthday on the 4th of September, Andre gave him letters from his family and his fiancée, which had been given to him before they left Danes Island. This is a happy surprise, though. But unfortunately, Strindberg later fell into the water and ruined all the rations that he was carrying.
Yeah, it was kind of a day of ups and downs. And then a few days after that, on September 9th, they realized once again that since they had switched directions on August 4th, they had again been thwarted by the movement of the ice. So they had been trying to travel a little more than 80 miles or roughly 129 kilometers southwest. But again, because the ice that they're walking on is also shifting, they had actually been drifting about the correct distance, but instead to the south-southeast. This is also the day when Andre's diary kind of drops off. He stops doing his regular entries, which seems like a little bit of a clue that he might be losing heart.
On September 17th, he wrote that an especially bad blister on Frankel's foot had rendered him unable to pull his sledge anymore. So he and Strindberg had been running back to get the third one and to play catch up with the others periodically as they all traveled. There had also been some snow, which added extra weight to everything. They managed to kill and eat a seal, and then they realized that they were going to be trapped out there on the ice through the winter. Even with all this hardship, he wrote, quote, "Our humor is pretty good, although joking and smiling are not of ordinary occurrence."
And on September 19th, there was actually a little bit of a ray of hope. Andre managed to shoot three seals, and that meant that with those, once they were dressed for food and their remaining food stores that they still had with them, they were going to be able to get through at least half of the winter. So they knew, like, they had rations for at least a little while. They could keep trying to gather more, and they might be in okay shape. Like, it looked like they might be able to do this. And they also started building a snow house on the ice that they were on to live in by forming snow into kind of like walls and structure and then pouring water over it to harden everything.
Their ice hut was completed on September 28th, but just 4 days later, the ice floe that they built it on broke apart and water came rushing in. The three men had to hustle to get all their supplies together and to get it up off the breaking ice before everything drifted away.
The end of the entry in Andre's diary, and he had two diaries, and this was the end of the first one, reads, quote, "No one had lost courage. With such comrades, one should be able to manage under, I may say, any circumstances."
With that kind of positive attitude, even in the face of complete misery and seemingly loss of all hope, the men started construction on another snow house 2 days later. They had spotted White Island earlier in their journey, but they thought they'd be unable to land there because it looked like it was totally iced over. But October 4th, which was the same day they had started on their new house, they also saw a spot on White Island where they thought they might actually be able to move ashore. On October 5th, they did. They named their new camp Mina Andre's Place after Andre's mother because October 5th was her birthday.
And so while it seems like things are looking up at this point in the story, Andre's last entry is just 3 days later on October 8th. He describes their happiness at being off the ice and actually on land and in a tent. And he kind of is sorting through what they're going to need to do, including collecting some driftwood and whale bones so that they can get some fires going and meet some other needs.
So we don't know for certain when or how the three adventurers died. When the White Island camp was discovered in 1930, their supplies were still in the boat. There was a pile of driftwood that was gathered but unused nearby. There was an entry in Strindberg's notebook for October 17th, which read home 7:05 a.m. But based on the fact that it was written in ink, which would have frozen and been unusable in the climate that the men were in, they believe that this was an expectation he had of arriving home in Sweden on a train.
Yeah, they think that entry was written long before any of their kind of polar adventures happened. As we said, the cause of death, we don't know, and it remains one of history's mysteries, and it will probably remain that way forever, because the remains that were found by the crew of the Norwegian sloop Bratvåg in 1930 were actually cremated before they were buried, so additional testing of those bodies can never be done.
We're going to step through some of the most common theories and some of the common arguments against them. So the first is poisoning from their food tins. There's a fingernail from a glove that was tested and had high levels of lead in it, but it's not believed to have been enough to have killed anyone.
There is also a theory that one of the men had a psychotic episode and it resulted in a murder-suicide. But since the men were rather shockingly upbeat throughout all of this horribleness, most people think this seems unlikely, although there certainly have been cases throughout history of people that seem really happy and excited and then they have a psychotic break. So it's possible, but we're not sure.
There's also the possibility of dehydration.
Yeah, there's not a lot of way you can detract that, since once they found these bodies, they were pretty much completely decomposed. So there wasn't any tissue to really test then.
Right.
Even if they were cremated, there's not much we wouldn't know.
Right. And a lot of the nearby water that would have been available to them would have been salt water that would not have helped them.
Trichinosis or botulism is another popular theory from eating uncooked polar bear or seal meat. None of the diaries really describe anything that could be pointed to as evidence of the symptoms associated with trichinosis. However, this was a new and exciting fact I learned while doing this research. Botulism is apparently really common in seal meat if it's not really thoroughly cooked. So it's possible we know they were eating seal. So that's one possibility.
People have suggested that it might have been scurvy, but 3 months really isn't long enough for scurvy to kill someone.
No, it can make you pretty sick in that time, but probably not to the point of fatality. Another theory that has been put forth is a polar bear attack. This one isn't really terribly likely. For one thing, Andre's gun was next to his body when they found it, so it seemed like he was actually like watching for danger, and it would have been unlikely. But also, the bodies that they found, Andre's looked like it may have been disturbed, but most people believe that may have happened by a bear after he had already been deceased, because it just looked kind of shuffled about. It didn't look so much like an attack situation.
There's also the idea that maybe since they had all this opium around, it was a deliberate opium overdose, but they had all seemed to be in such reasonably good spirits that that seems maybe not as likely.
Yeah, you would think that if they were coming to that conclusion, there would have been a diary entry about it. Another one that is sometimes brought up is the possibility of vitamin A poisoning from polar bear liver. However, we know that the men knew of this danger. They wrote about it. So it seems unlikely that they would have taken that risk.
They could have asphyxiated because they were maybe using their cook stove inside the tent.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Again, we don't know for sure. That one, there's... It's kind of like, maybe we don't have a lot of evidence one way or the other.
Well, there's the reasonable people would probably think that's a bad idea, but that's the only counter argument I have.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, there are opiates involved. So there's the possibility that at some point they went, you know, it would be great and it will keep the tent warm. Let's bring it in. The last theory that we're going to mention almost seems in some ways like the most obvious, which is that they died from cold and exhaustion. I mean, at this point, they had been dragging these multi-hundred-pound sledges around for a while. They had gotten wet in freezing water repeatedly. You know, they were struggling with other issues. They were dosing with opium and morphine. Like, their bodies were taking a lot of abuse.
Yeah. Well, I keep thinking about two different video games during this episode. And one is like, this feels like a frozen wasteland version of Oregon Trail. And the other is one of my favorite things to play recently, which is a game called The Long Dark, which is basically about surviving in this frozen wilderness. And one of the things that happens in The Long Dark is if you go to sleep and it turns out it's not warm enough to keep your body warm and survive, you die. And it just, the little thing comes up that just says you have faded into the long dark. And I think the most believable thing is that they thought they were warm enough to sleep through the night, but they were not.
Yeah, which would make sense because, you know, we don't, unlike something like the Dyatlov Pass incident where we see people like paradoxical undressing and trying to dig through the snow, this seems like everything was pretty undisturbed. And if I'm understanding my research correctly, it seems like they all died probably around the same time, which is one of the reasons that like the opium theory gains a lot of fans. It's like, well, they all died around the same time. Surely, at least we think that based on how the bodies were positioned. For all we know, they died and were propped up by, you know, another of the men, and they certainly couldn't bury them in the ice. So we don't really know. But what we do know is that once those remains were discovered in 1930 and the men were returned to Sweden, finally, they were really greeted as heroes. Remember, this was a big effort on Sweden's part. Like, there was a lot of fervor around it. There was a lot of excitement that Sweden could be the country that got to the North Pole first through this amazing approach that no one else had ever tried. The king had backed them. So, and then they vanished. So there was a lot of, there were a lot of question marks that were finally getting some answers. And when they finally arrived there in Sweden, 200 ships had joined the procession to bring them home. And King Gustav V met them at the pier.
Among the items that were recovered from Camp Mina Andre's place were several cans of film. Some of the film was damaged or exposed, but there were 93 frames that were intact and were later developed. Strindberg was the photographer more often than not. He had dabbled in photography prior to the expedition. There are images of Andre and Frankel with a polar bear they'd killed, and there's an image of the balloon lying on its side with Andre and Frankel standing nearby. There's even a timed exposure shot of all three of the men who are pulling one of the heavy sledges.
And you can actually see these photos at the Gröna Museum in Sweden, and they also have them online. The museum has scanned them all and put them online, and we'll include that link in the show notes.
Because of the 3 decades that this film spent out in the freezing cold, the images are not particularly perfect. They're flared and burned out. Some of them have ghostly images of the three men. The view of Andre in public opinion has really shifted throughout the years. Sometimes people label him as a madman. Other times people paint him as the hero of Sweden. And sometimes they portray him more as a fool who had dreams of fame and glory. But he and his companions were, it would seem, really courageous and tenacious, if nothing else.
Yeah, I'm so blown away perpetually by just how, like, upbeat they managed to stay through all of this. Because I know I would be a whiny complainer right about the moment that we lost the ropes at the beginning of the trip. But I also would not probably do a trip like this because I enjoy the comforts of home. Yeah, it's such a wild story. We've had a few requests for this. It pops up in various places. Sort of a ceaseless fascination. So, and it's one of those things that we could go on forever and ever because a lot of the journals have been digitized and can be read online. And it's very, very cool stuff.
Thanks so much for joining us on this Saturday. Since this episode is out of the archive, if you heard an email address or a Facebook URL or something similar over the course of the show, that could be obsolete now. Our current email address is historypodcast@iheartradio.com. Our old How Stuff Works email address no longer works. You can find us all over social media at Missed in History. And you can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without the essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. I mean, it provides great protection and it's really breathable so you don't get hot. That's a win-win. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without finger sticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.